The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 252, a paper entitled A Management Consultant Looks at Today's Church by John Targin, with a response from Michael J. Stevens.
It could be financial as well as emotional and others.
Spiritual.
A place to help us take care of our kids. You know, it's interesting, in Bakersfield we have a yearly religion symposium on Gandhi's birthday, and one of my good buddies is a religious studies professor and had a bunch of people come together, and for the first time ever, a couple of years ago, they asked my daughter, with me as coach, to present Mormonism. They had students present Mormonism. It was interesting, but one of the things in that presentation she was talking about, I was thinking about, and the reason that he asked to have Mormonism as opposed to other forms of Christianity present, I mean, we had Buddhism, Jainism, and some Christianity, was the fact that he just noticed how wonderful the Mormon teens seem to be. And that, I think that's a big part of it. And it's not something in my paper, so underline that one.
Yeah, this is probably the third of the
Okay, a way to achieve salvation and the promise of reward.
Of the universe, how it works.
An understanding of the, I call that a purpose to life. But. A way to become a god, to get ahead of everyone else. Okay. No, not get ahead of it, but to be totally fulfilled. Okay, all good. Let me forge on, and it's really awkward because this isn't a class, and you didn't do your reading ahead of time, and all the rest. And so, but I still want you to blurt out, especially when I give my suggestions. Say, you idiot, that doesn't make sense because I prefer. But I did have. I put here with the benefit of working at a more leisurely pace. I came up with the following ideas, which are basically the ones that you said. I think. Yeah, we'll check them off. Peace of mind from an equitable afterlife. Now, if that means becoming a god or being happy in the terrestrial kingdom, I often thought, as long as I have golf and people that I feel comfortable around, I'd rather be in terrestrial than anywhere else. But oh, I shouldn't say that. Okay. But a clear purpose to life. I put connectedness through family and social ties, extended family. Opportunities for service was not met. And it's interesting because I had one friend who... where's David? He's here. Argues about why intelligent design doesn't make sense to him, et cetera, et cetera. But he told me, this was years after I met him, it was one of Janet's colleagues at the university who's since retired, but I think he has a fundamentalist brother-in-law and a fundamentalist brother who have rejected him, both. And he's very sensitive about things, and he told me, you're the only person that's ever given me a good reason to go to church. And I told him, he asked me years ago, why do you still go to church? And I said, well, it gives me an opportunity to serve in the fellowship and stuff. And he didn't have a reply for that or a rebuttal. He said, but anyway, opportunities for service really are big for many people, I think. Meeting growth needs through the development of skills such as public speaking, teaching, leadership, and learning. And I don't think this one should be downplayed at all. Maybe that's not why people seek out the church, but I think it certainly keeps many of them in. And I put down, this is the kind of the traditional religion, that it helps us through transitions, at birth and marriage, and into retirement. But do we have any transition support when people retire? You send them on really nice vacations where they feel like they're doing something worthwhile. Maybe it's not a vacation, I'm sorry. But some people can request some pretty nice places to go. Okay. Now, having said that, let's think about a marketing perspective. Any changes that you can think of that would improve or expand helping you to raise your youth and the peace of mind, and I can't remember all the ones that you said that I didn't, but peace of mind message, the clear purpose to life message, connectedness through family and social ties, becoming a god, opportunities for service, meeting growth needs, and support during transitional events. Janet.
Well, I just came up with a new one. It was healthy lifestyle and health.
Okay, a healthy, happy lifestyle. All right. What? Any thoughts of how we could market those things more effectively? Well, think about it, and you can blurt out. And I suspect this would happen. It's things like my students, they say, well, and then you say something controversial, and they'll jump down your throats and start raising their hands. And maybe I'll say a few things controversial, and you want to jump down my throat. Okay. All right. So John's ideas for improving the marketing of things. Okay. One, I believe peace of mind and a clear purpose to life are the most important goods the church offers. My first bit of advice would be to streamline the message of the Mormon gospel. Currently, there is a lot to digest. I would suggest concentrating on the following. Adam was the first human, in parentheses, but he's the first father of human race. Even though we do not fully understand all the processes involved in creating the earth and filling it with life. We know that God's interaction with man has been continuous since Adam, although prophets have not always been available to reveal and interpret God's will. Which is funny, because I went to this thing on the missionary discussions yesterday, and it kind of sounds like the same thing I wrote here. The Old Testament prophets prepared the way for Christ, who brought the full gospel. Much was lost after Christ's coming. God prepared a land of religious freedom for the restoration of the full gospel. It is being restored through a mixture of visitation, revelation, and inspiration. Revelation and inspiration continue to guide the restoration. Joseph Smith was an important prophet, but was only the first in a line of prophets whom God is inspiring to restore the fullness of Christ's gospel. The Book of Mormon and other modern scriptures are important mechanisms for restoring the truth, but just one part of the ongoing process. Now, I don't know if there's anything heretical about that, but it's pretty simple. Why rework and streamline the message, one might ask? Well, I believe that this would make it more accessible to more individuals, both current and prospective members. And again, I think that it's already being done. They're certainly streamlining the missionary discussions. It would help to avoid much of the messiness associated with all emerging religions. Churches refine and discard doctrines as they develop. We are chronologically so close to the life of Joseph Smith that his blemishes are still emerging, and his original teachings are still being refined. Presenting him as one in a line of fallible yet holy prophets removes many of the arguments of opponents of the church. It would make the message more palatable to others. The Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham are difficult to defend as historical texts, but less so as mechanisms for restoring truth. The concept of ongoing restoration takes off the pressure to support the validity of doctrines and practices once represented as divine, yet now discarded. Nobody's grabbed the mic from me yet, so I'll plow on. Okay, one of the most significant opportunities for service is missionary work. The opportunity could be broadened by allowing some flexibility in the job assignments of missionaries. Perhaps young men and women could mix more service or manual labor with proselytizing, or we could allow different types of experiences for young people, as we do with retired folks. Perhaps we could experiment with a pre-mission option for 18-year-olds that would take time off their ultimate full-time commitment and allow them to have a realistic job preview while helping them to understand the type of missionary experience that is best suited to them. Some flexibility in lengths of missions might also make sense. Educational, financial, and familial circumstances vary across individuals and parts of the world. I think the differential treatment of men and women missionaries is anachronistic. I would have women serve at the same age as men and have the same options for service. Okay, why do this? For one, again, I'm trying to be this management consultant, not an advocate, but anyway. For one, I think that having flexibility in the amount of service for missionaries would have public relations value. People around the world know Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses as clean-cut pests. Having more visible service by young men and women would help change this image. For another, individuals have differences in aptitudes, or exhibit differences in aptitudes, abilities, and commitment. You know, I went once about a year on my mission presenting every concept and knocking on every door. That was a bird. I'm just saying that I had a series of companion items. Maybe they kept giving them to me for a certain reason. I don't know. It punished me, perhaps. But we all know that. There's differing levels of commitment, experience, whatever, or readiness. Okay, the question is about how different missions have different standards in terms of serving the communities where they are. Yeah, they do.
So that is kind of under the public relations one that I would like to see happen.
Right. I would like, well, yeah, the question is that under the public relations? Yes, I envision that it would be even individual, not just across missions, but that maybe my thought is you could sign up and do primarily service work. If you didn't want to be out, or you know, the majority of that. One of the interesting things, my wife was set aside after 2 years in Project Guatemala, was set aside as a short-term health services missionary, spent, what, about 2 months actually teaching the lessons? But there were a couple of them that had the opportunity to serve with a pair of other missionaries. Right, short-term full-time missionaries, a wonderful experience. And I think that, you know, that worked out very well in that circumstance. It caused me to think, well, there are a lot of people that may not have 2 years to commit or have whatever, or maybe they're as hard as an in it. Maybe if they're out there building chapels for a while, maybe they're feeling a little more comfortable easing into some of these other roles because they've been virtuous and they've been reading the scriptures and all the rest. Anyway, as an outsider, I'm saying, boy, you have one size fits all for this very big commitment. I mean, even the Army says we're an army of one. Now, that's stupid, of course, because you want to be part of a team. But the army of one means you can tailor your military experience to meet your needs. Well, why doesn't the Mormon Church do the same thing? Okay. Here's a... I'm reminded of a colleague. By the way, he was the chair of the entire CSU faculty, 21,000 faculty members. It's the largest university system in the world. He attained some prominence in my university system. He confided to me that he never really had a testimony, but successfully served a mission to Japan doing clerical work in the mission office. This arrangement worked well for him and the organization. I would also do something about the age differential of male and female missionaries. I think that most would agree that young women are usually at least as emotionally and spiritually mature as young men of the same age. Lowering the service age would make this service more feasible to many young women. The reasons I have heard for deferring do not seem to make much sense anymore, if they ever did. Women are marrying later now, and a year or two of early service would likely not interfere with marriage and family, but would help build a foundation for rearing service-oriented and faithful offspring.
What about sex?
Well, I think the question is, what about romance in the mission field? Right, and my wife brought up that same thing, is that if there's an age differential, that if you have a 21-year-old as opposed to a 20-and-a-half-year-old, that they wouldn't get together because older women are unattractive. The women don't like the younger men. Right, I believe if sister missionaries want to have sexual liaisons, they can find them outside of the missionaries. Right. The point is that because men and women are treated differentially, that may be an important distinction that's attractive to males, that they get the first crack and women only if they don't have other things to do, and you might lose that. It's the duty of men, and it's an opportunity for women. True, and I agree with that. I just think, though, I'm trying to be independent and think that my perception is that doesn't hold water. I think you would attract and retain more strong young women if they were doing the missionary service, and I think they would stay active longer and all the rest. Well, we'll get to that point. I'm not a chauvinist, but I'm trying to look at this in terms of demographics, and I do think the male demographic is more important for churches, but you can yell at me in just a minute. Okay. In keeping with the gender theme, I assure you that being the father of only daughters has nothing to do with my next suggestion. Girls should have a public role in the sacrament ritual. By the way, this is one of the things that got me called in. What is it, in 93 or whatever it was, and it was, you know, a hot part of one of my papers was underlined where I said girls should be able to pass the sacrament. The ritual surrounding the sacrament is an important public service opportunity. Girls could prepare and distribute the sacrament alongside boys. Deacons and teachers, in turn, could focus even more on other priesthood-related duties, such as collecting fast offerings and accompanying home teachers. Why make this change? Well, first of all, there is no scriptural or doctrinal prohibition against it. That's one of the phrases that got me in trouble. But more importantly, it would signal an equal appreciation of boys and girls, which is part of marketing the product. As the world becomes more liberated in their views of the sexes, a more prominent role for girls might make the message more accessible to potential converts and help some members feel more comfortable. Even my backwards-imaged Bakersfield has a female rabbi. Changes like this can be made without damage to the central message of the church. Oh, by the way, the slide said, help prepare and distribute, not bless, in parentheses. Okay, still in keeping with this theme, I would continue to give high-profile positions to women in the church, beyond Sherry Dow, or whatever her name is. Do. And accelerate their movement into other areas of leadership while maintaining some priesthood functions for males. Thank you, Levina, for before. Okay. Why? The reasons for doing this overlap with the ones I have discussed already. More women will find the church a comfortable place to be. However, I think that one of the real attractions of the church for many is the fact that it gives a special place to males. Male participation may be one of the most important keys to any religion's success. Maintaining special roles for males seems to be the most effective way to ensure their participation. I would not suggest a fundamental change in the way that leadership and priesthood are interconnected. I would just suggest more opportunities for women in roles that do not specifically require priesthood authority. Well, I think there's almost, other than blessing the sacrament and setting people apart and doing, you know, laying hands, where you have to actually put hands on people, I personally think there ought to be a woman in the room when a bishop does a worthiness interview.
Presiding at sacrament meeting?
I don't know why women could not run a sacrament meeting.
So they could conduct
Or conduct, well, yeah, conduct, call it whatever, you know, conduct it. You know, it's like, you know, I don't want to be too flippant about this, but it's like the, you know, the state president sits up there, his family's in the audience, and he has no part in the program. What the heck are you doing up there on the stage? It's like a mannequin or something.
Presiding.
Yeah, I understand. But it doesn't take a lot of strain to preside. Okay. But thank you for the comments. I'm willingness to entertain them, but the problem is I have to repeat them in here, and I'm not so sure all of them wish to be repeated. Are you? Okay, I would suggest exploring different levels and types of curriculum pedagogy across the church. I use a very different pedagogy and approach when teaching research methods to graduate students than I do when teaching introduction to information systems to undergraduates. I think it makes sense to treat instruction in the church differently on the Wasatch Front in affluent wards than one would in a developing nation new to Mormonism. While it almost goes without saying, we should be aware that individuals and societies learn in different modalities. To believe that people most effectively learn the gospel by sitting in front of a blackboard and responding to prompts after reading pages of printed words all around the world is a bit naive. And let me go on, because there has been some talk about teaching the mission lesson, missionary lessons, and streamlining all the rest of the manuals are thinner now and give leeway. I'm telling you, very few people understand that some people like storytelling. That's how they learn. Others, you know, you role play or you empathize. Even there are differences between males and females. And it seems like we think that, okay, reading a manual, preparing ahead of time and coming prepared to discuss. All right, I'll get one pet peeve in, and this is not a. This is I'm stepping out of my role here, but the whole idea that you should read the First Presidency message so that you can take it to Elders' Quorum, maybe prepare to have someone else read it to you there, so that you can take it to your families and read it to them, and then they can come and visit you and read it back to you. It's probably not effective pedagogy, but there are many other ways to get the point across. And I think of one time, sorry for digressing, and then I'll stop doing this, but I remember in an Elders' Quorum, I did this role play, and remember the book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People? It was written by a rabbi. And I started giving this thing, and I was doing some role playing, and I played this distraught husband who'd lost his wife and was railing against God and how terrible this was. And in the context of, you have to let people go through the grieving cycle. You know, like Job is the grieving ritual. You can understand it that way. And he goes through, he rails against God, and then finally resolves it and works it out. He's allowed to be angry, and then he finally comes around. Well, we did that role play, and the Elders' Quorum president, this young, nice guy, but just, anyway, he was just attacking me. Well, you don't have a testimony, and you're going to need to repent and all the rest. And then we went through this training and role-playing, and then he got put in the position of the bishop after we've done all this. And he was like, oh, you know, we just need to give this brother time to grieve and time to... But it was a whole different way of learning about, you know, grieving, because we actually went through and we role-played. And when teaching people about harassment in the workplace and ethical things, you know, having scenarios, role-playing, sharing experiences are all many times very superior than to just learning points, sitting and reading and kind of having people regurgitate them, explain the points. Okay, in a similar vein, I would recommend local options for hymns, dress, and customs associated with worship. This could allow more people to feel comfortable with a message that is mediated in a mode that is more comfortable to them. And I put, it would also allow a broader sense of connectedness to other members of the church for whom the Wasatch Front Convention seem alien. And, you know, I find that funny that, who was it that was saying, who was the, is it Ashcroft? I think it was John Ashcroft, who is broadly viewed as kind of backwards and maybe kind of a racist because he's from Missouri. He used to go to the black churches in Washington because he found the white churches unspiritual, because he liked the music and he liked the enthusiasm and the ardor, a very different modality of worshiping. And, you know, to think that, you know, we're very corporate, you know that. We sit there and we're very passive learners and we all have to be quiet. And, we, you know, if kids are making noise, that's a bad thing. You know, we don't have them standing up. And I remember just how foreign it felt to go to my sister's charismatic congregation with the tambourines and all the rest. And after a while, you know, after going there a few times, I said, no, this is really a lot better than our sacrament meetings. So, you know, people really are into it and they're feeling the spirit. Okay. I may not even know. They don't allow this? Okay. I didn't know if they changed the policy, but religions give important support during transitional times. A sore spot for many is the prohibition of civil marriage ceremonies in conjunction with temple ceilings. You know, my mom and sister had to wait outside. I suggest changing the policy so that a large public ceremony attended by all could be viewed as a way to celebrate the marriage ceiling in a temple. Why do this? One reason is probably obvious to those who have parts of families that cannot attend ceilings. It detracts from the event and makes that transition support less effective than it could be. A perhaps less obvious reason is the image such a policy gives the church in the eyes of other religions and potential converts. And I would not minimize this. People think we are really screwy. It seems arbitrary and unnecessary, if not unchristian. And I'm telling you, I think the reaction to this is that we're not Christian. How could you prohibit people from celebrating someone, you know, this important part of their life?
So are you saying we should let non-Mormons into the temple?
No, I would not. What I would do is I'd say that maybe you have a brief temple ceiling beforehand with certain members, but then you allow a large wedding, civil wedding, in conjunction with that. And you can say, you know, we're celebrating their ceiling for all time,
on
but you have
day. Don't make them
on the exact same day with all sorts of people. And boy, you talk about a better missionary tool, because here you have these good, you know, clean-cut, nice, hopeful, young folks who are willing to make this commitment, and having committed to, you know, chastity ahead of time and all the rest and live all the standards of the church. What a missionary tool. But is it now? We say, no, it's special. We're doing something here you can't see.
Well, since people wear street clothes when they observe ceilings in the temple, why not let non-Mormons watch it? It's a beautiful ceremony.
Oh, right. The question was, since people can already wear, they don't have to dress in temple robes or anything to watch the ceilings, why not let them in the temple? Right. A supporting comment is they could come through separate entrances.
It's like, what a nice ceremony the Mormons have.
Right, and they could see the ceremony, and it would seem a nice one. I have a response to that, but there's another question.
No different than Jewish or, you know,
Hindu. One more question or comment related?
Do you think that the temple, requiring people to go to the temple and being ready to go to the temple to attend, like, their daughter's wedding or whatever, is an important social
right. The idea is having this be a special ceremony with a special restriction to those who can attend, isn't that important? As a management consultant, I'd say, yeah. You know, being able to feel like you're in the inner circle is a really important thing, whether it's, you know, endowment, ceiling, second anointing, all that stuff. This idea of I'm special, I think, is an important part of the brand, and it holds people in. Now, don't mistake that for thinking that I think that that's the way it should be. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that I think I agree with that comment, and that would be the reason why you wouldn't let them see it, because there's something special that anybody could go to the big wedding. But I have to think about that a little bit. I'm not disagreeing with it, just saying I'm not so sure if that would work effectively. The question was, had I seen the letters to the editor? No, I was unaware of that. The letters, it's related to allowing family in. Yeah. Okay, people are very polarized, which I will respond to that. It's, well, yeah, Newell. Right. The comment was made that in some parts of the world they require a civil ceremony. The government does not recognize a temple ceiling in lieu of a civil ceremony. Of course, and this has been done for many years, and we know that there are. So again, I don't believe that there certainly is no practice, formalized practice, that would prohibit this. There certainly is no doctrine against it. It is a practice or a policy, but it's not an inviolate policy, because where it can't be followed, it's not followed. So I don't think it would be a big change, but I think from a PR point of view, it would be a very good one. Personally, with my personal voice stepping out of this role, I'd say, my gosh, it's the only Christian thing to do. But, go ahead. Oh, interesting. Apparently in Alaska, before the temple, most people, the overwhelming majority, would have a civil ceremony and still be allowed to have a temple ceremony. Okay, well, again, I don't think it's a big deal, but it's, again, from the perspective of trying to market the brand and make the product or the good of this church more appealing, I think this would be an important thing that they might want to consider. Okay, again, I'm playing like they've hired me, but I don't think that they would. Okay, The next suggestion may be my most controversial. I recommend downplaying revelation and divine intervention in church affairs while emphasizing inspired policy. While church leaders may be holy people and inspired, they are not infallible. While church leaders... I suggest making formal doctrinal pronouncement rarely and make them narrowly tailored. They should be vetted by the entire First Presidency and Quorum of 12 prior to release. There's a lot of smart people there who are savvy. Okay. Why do this when continuing revelation is an important pillar of the message? Well, mistakes will be made. Downplaying revelation will make good public relations and the relationships with members much easier. Again, I'm talking a practical thing here. My take is that the need for true doctrinal pronouncements is rare. The message of salvation and the importance of connectedness is pretty good as it is. Changing inspired policy is not as difficult and risky as changing doctrine. It poses a lot of problems for members.
Would you say this is what we're doing in the church today?
Oh, yes. The question is, in the church, are we doing a lot of these things? Absolutely. I find it ironic. I sat down and tried to think of things. And as I'm sitting at the Sunstone Symposium, I'm hearing all these things that are actually being changed. But a good consultant would probably tell them to do some of the things they're already doing. Maybe just do more of them. Now this last one is a little gratuitous. If I put avoid risk to the brand, you got to be real careful. And, you know, people leave because, you know, poor Big Muscles, Brent Metcalf. Sorry, I shouldn't put that on a tape. He was just sitting here, so I'm pointing to him. He's not there. Yeah, he broke his arm. Okay. But Brent talked about how just distraught he was when, I'm assuming President Kimball with the magnifying glass, couldn't tell that Mark Hoffman's forgery was a forgery. It just devastated him. Well, if we hold up these leaders as being infallible rather than inspired, good people, you run that risk. It's hard to protect the brand. And when things, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of things that come out in every, and, you know, or our organization is like any other. And anyway, I think you protect yourself, and I would suggest, you know, just like other types of insurance, I'd get infallibility insurance or whatever you'd call it. Okay. Another recommendation would be to expand ecumenical efforts and charitable efforts to those outside the church. Not that this isn't being done already, but I just do even more. This should make the message more appealing and less intimidating. We should remember that Mormonism is still viewed by many as cultic. Oops, that was... Okay, I can't go back. The historical insularity of the church has diminished its appeal to many potential members. Reaching out for commonality and through service can help to communicate the core message and change people's perception that the organization is out of the mainstream and therefore unworthy of consideration. Yeah?
What would you do with the message that we're the only true church?
The question is, the message that we are the only true church, would I emphasize that or downplay it? My message is the fullness of the gospel has been restored and we can help families go back into the presence of God and be happy forever. I would not even bring it up. I'd say we're the best. I mean, if you want to say, we hope that we're the best vehicle for doing that and that God has put prophets in our church with continuing inspiration to go. Well, I think internally you have to say that we have prophets, that God has named prophet in our church. I think that it's better for the brand to say that there is truth and inspiration. I mean, I cut this out of the paper. I say, in Sunday school lessons, you ought to talk about Gandhi and you know, a lot of virtuous people in the world, and Martin Luther King. You would greatly, I think, expand the reach of missionaries and make their task easier while saying, kind of like the Baha'i, many temples are many prophets, many great inspired people in the world. However, the Baha'u'llah came and he was the true one. And I think we can say, prophets are the ones the official with the sealing authority and all the rest, but we are going to embrace truth wherever we find it. That's a long answer to a short question, but no, I think it's important for people inside to feel like it is the true, only true church, but I would soft pedal that a little bit. Not everything is true. It's kind of the thing, you know?
Why is it important that they think that it's the only...
Not the only true church, but that it is maybe the best way to get back to God and has the priesthood, I suppose. Let me think about that a little bit and I'll get back to it again. Okay, I'm not sure if the next recommendation belongs in a marketing section. And I hate to rush through this because I really do like the comments more, but I'm going to do it anyway. Sorry. Or it belongs here in the organizational section. It is to focus the message even more on the importance of the family unit and the ward as surrogate family unit. And I can't emphasize that enough. Ward as family, I think, is something that's extremely important. One of the reasons religion has always had appeal is the uncertainty in the world. The modern world contains even more uncertainty given the changes in so many of the things we have taken for granted. This is likely the reason for the paradox of why fundamentalism is on the rise even as society progresses. But think about it. Advances in agriculture, industry, technology, and information have not given us certainty or provided meaning. Belonging to an extended family unit and or to a surrogate family ward unit, family/ward unit, with the promise that these relationships will continue forever, can provide great comfort in a dynamic, unsettling world. Okay, organizational issues. The next set of ideas revolves around the church as a large organization made up of many individuals. The structure of the organization, in other words, the reporting relationships, the communication patterns, the development and management of organizational members, and the policies and procedures that govern the functioning of the organization would fit under this category. All right, any ideas about how we could improve maybe the... I think I have a slide. Oops. Well, you saw that one. Oops.
How about our best
it says, wait. Structural ones? Nah, that's all right. I did notice one person doing a presentation, and they kind of covered up some of their, they had an overhead and were covering up some of the points. And students always tell me, don't cover them up. You know, it just makes us, you know, lose focus.
Paul II got a lot of mileage for the Catholic Church by apologizing for the way they treated the Jews and then apologizing for the way they treated Galileo. In view of how happy the church was when the legislature in Illinois came up with their quasi-apology, I think we ought to just look in the mirror, and we ought to apologize for the Mountain Meadows Massacre publicly and loudly. We ought to apologize for what we've done with the blacks. We ought to apologize to...
Okay, let me stop right there. The comment is, since the Catholic Church has gotten a lot of mileage out of atoning for their past mistakes, maybe the Mormon Church has stepped up to the plate because they like apologies from places like the Illinois Legislature for what they did, but maybe we should apologize for unfortunate instances like Mountain Meadows Massacre and you were saying the others?
The
treatment of people with African descent. Okay, in other words, admit mistakes. I would not put that in this section, but I think that that's a good thing. You know, it's just like people said in relation to Watergate, it wasn't the act, it was the cover-up. And that's true of all organizations. Every PR firm is going to tell you, get it over with. You know, mea culpa, it really wasn't that bad for the following reasons, and here's what we're doing to atone. We're going to give, you know, $100,000 to Y. That's always a better course than to try and cover things up. So,
I think the communication should be two-way. Right now it is pretty one-way.
Okay, communication. In other words, instead of being so top-down that like David O. McKay was reputed to have done during his administration last night, at least they mentioned that he listened to folks, he talked to people in the hallways and others and always asked them for their ideas. I don't think he accepted all of them, but he certainly was open to receiving ideas. And that's a principle of management that's pretty universal that, you know, the people actually doing the work. People teaching Sunday school to teenagers probably know a lot more about what effective curricula would look like than people maybe sitting in an office building in Salt Lake City or wherever they're sitting. Other suggestions?
They can assign general authorities to come to Sunstone.
General authorities could go out and maybe do more outreach to other groups.
They have to come and attend and sit and listen.
Yeah, come to Sunstone. And that sounds a little flippant, but I don't think it is, because we know that the effect of organizations in terms of marketing, MTV and a lot of these brands that make hundreds of millions of dollars, literally, around the world, they pay people to go to clubs and to talk to folks and interview them and find out what's on their minds. And I think, I don't know if I would send the general authorities there, maybe not the apostles, but maybe some younger ones, but certainly going to places like Sunstone and others to have that dialogue and conversation. If I were telling them, giving advice on marketing, I would certainly tell them to do that. Meet the peeps, because that's where the new ideas are, that's where you learn about the market. Some general authorities have gone to MHA.
Yeah, Martin Jansen and Mormon History Association.
Mormon History Association.
Came to our, yeah, he was present, went to some of the sessions, And prior to that, it was Todd Christofferson. And I guess the reason that those two got selected to, they ended up going to MHA. Todd Christofferson actually attended it twice. I think he attended when we met in Kirtland. He was in Kirtland. And then I believe he was also when we met in Crow. Wasn't that right, Melina? And then last year, Marlon K. Jensen, attended. I think it was a good feeling because, there was that kind of interaction and a feeling that, maybe there's somebody up there listening or reacting to some of the things.
Right. The comment was that was a good thing. And my first reaction is, well, of course it might make the people who go to those types of things feel good. But I also believe that it's most organizations are more successful if people get around the management by walking around type of thing. I point out that one of my good friends from Mission Field and I went golfing yesterday morning, and we talked about it was his companion twice, but the three of us spent most of our missions together as a general authority now, and he mentioned how he had changed and how insulated, and we talked about the pressure, especially if you've got the pressure of being infallible, and how that really has changed this person, I think made him less open and certainly less perceptive of people's feelings. I think you get put in the role of being a leader, and you have to have the pressure that you have all the ideas. Now, this is not just religious organizations. It's all organizations. Many, many managers, unfortunately, the ineffective ones, tend to feel that they must have all the answers. In certain countries, like in France, a boss would never ask a subordinate a question because they're afraid, well, if I ask them the question, they're going to think, I shouldn't have my position. And I suspect that that's the feeling among many church leaders when we find just the opposite. I found that the CEOs I've known have often been the most open and are collecting information, wanting to know what your ideas are and how you do, because they're in a position where they have to have lots of contacts and networks in order to get good ideas. The better ones, yeah, the better ones. And the ones I've met that I thought were good, it was remarkable. They'd ask me a question and actually listen. Whereas the strivers, a lot of times, just want to tell you what they thought. Okay, where am I? Oh, BYU, my alma mater. Yeah. My first structural suggestion would be for the church to cut the formal organizational ties with Brigham Young University. However, I would suggest maintaining church leader seats on the board of trustees, even a majority if possible. I would suggest continuing a high but tapering level of financial support. Lost subsidies could be made up by greatly increased tuition for those who can afford it and dramatically increasing student aid to worthy individuals who cannot. All right. Wouldn't this result in fundamental changes to the mission and effectiveness in BYU? Well, I don't know why. Standards, values, honor codes, etc. could still be maintained. I believe the university would almost certainly continue on the same course with only a few trivial changes, I'll say, if it were no longer an official arm of the church. Issues of academic freedom and financial pressures are vexing. I think that it is reasonable to expect church leaders to effectively set policy. I think it is unrealistic or unreasonable to expect church leaders to effectively set policy for a research-oriented university that is also seen as a reflection of the church itself. If they teach that at BYU, it must be okay. Or if they don't teach that at BYU, it isn't okay. Or if this professor acts this way, and it's just a very difficult, and I think it just causes too many problems for the church. Oh, and then the last one would be, of course, they spend way too much money, I would say, for the benefit they get. Okay, or the church gets.
Why don't you say the whole university?
Right. I would say that's all part of the same. The question was, why not BYU Hawaii and BYU Idaho? And I think any institution that is seen as a full-fledged university, especially a research university, would make sense. Church College of Hawaii, I think you could argue, is more of a seminary than a research university, but we can have that argument later.
Back to your expense thing, I thought BYU paid for itself because graduates of BYU on the whole pay more tithing than more than pay tithing.
Right, the idea is that they pay for it through their tithing. I'm sorry, most people that pay tithing don't get into BYU. So that, to me, it's a fairness issue.
So the church is getting more money because of
I see, because people go to BYU, they're more faithful tithe payers.
Yeah.
Okay, and there may be studies.
So that's an indoctrination.
Okay. And if I were to do a more formal follow-up, they'd say, you're an idiot. We raise money from BYU, and it pays itself back. And I say, okay, forget about it. Still divest because of the other reasons. Whatever. Okay, another area of potential concern is the issue of worthiness interviews. Private sessions in which sensitive issues are discussed are thorny enough for organizations without adding the complications of age and power differences between the participants and gender issues. At a minimum, awareness training should be increased. Less intrusive probing should be considered, as well as the possibility of a third party being present and some potential for reporting of problems. This is for you, Levina. In addition, expanding support services for those in counseling roles should be considered. The potential exposure of the church in situations where delicate situations are discussed is enormous. Bishops, stake presidents, and others currently receive training, but it should probably be examined for adequacy. They should also have easy access to a variety of services, including mental health services, legal advice, not for the people doing the interviews, but support so that they could more effectively give counseling or refer. I know there is some of this, but I would increase it. In an organization as large as the LDS Church, problems are likely to arise that will more likely be dealt with effectively if leaders have more training and resources to draw upon. And that function of ombudsperson, I think, is one that should be considered as well. Okay, comments? Okay, the idea of the policies in some places where singles are not allowed to be alone with women, or maybe even with their companion, with single men, with women. Yeah, men and women can't drive alone together in cars. While those might seem silly as adults, from an organizational perspective, I would say I think those policies make a lot of sense to avoid those potential problems. In the back and then in the front? Would I advise the church to open up their finances?
Only to tithe payers.
Yeah. The question, I don't know. I reserve judgment. And I think the reason is, one is, it seems like a big issue for a very small number of people. And I don't know that they need to do it. It's certainly not a public corporation. On the other hand, I think that if it becomes a problem where the Rocky Mountain, who did the big expose? The Denver Post did one, and there's the NAIF. Anyway, there's some exposés. I just think those only caused a little ripple. I don't think we've lost members because we don't do a public audit. We have private audit.
The issue of accountability
and responsibility. Yeah. Right. The question is accountability and responsibility. Frankly, I don't think most people care about that. I do, but I don't think that would significantly impact the number of members, new members joining the church, or the faithfulness of those inside the church.
In keeping with this idea, if a sister had something to confess, she could do it to her Relief Society president instead of the bishop.
I would have the question is, should women be able to confess to other women? My view is the Relief Society president ought to be there, and certainly the primary young women's president ought to be there when he's talking to young girls. The comment is the Relief Society president ought to be able to sign a temple recommend for sisters. Yeah, I like that idea, and I think it would work. It's just, does it conflict with the specialness of males and the role of the priest and all the rest? I don't know. If I were to change things, if I were God and I knew all things, and my judgment would be, yeah, of course you do that. But I'm not. But it's interesting, but if I were a consultant giving advice, I'd put a third person in that room.
Well,
if nothing else, to check.
The bishop isn't accused later.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's insurance that the bishop or other authority wouldn't be accused of something, but also that they wouldn't do anything. And some of the questions are more probing than they need to be for reasons other than establishing what people need to do to repent.
I'm not
Albert.
A counselor, but I think talking to two people is very different from talking to one man.
Right. And the point is brought up, being a counselor is more difficult when you have another person in the room. I don't think most bishops are trained in counseling, and I'd say the advice that I would not take advice from a bishop on most matters, other than what I need to do to get back in the good graces of God, which I think, that the bishop has the right to give you that advice. There's a lot of common sense. And I'd say the same thing of lots of church leaders, that they give a lot of advice and common sense. And I read these books by general authorities, and it sounds great. And then if I go to a professional conference and I hear what the experts say, I say, oops, what sounded good when I read it there or heard it doesn't sound so good anymore. Cut me off if I need to stop, Mike. Okay, four or five minutes. All right. We know about that. Okay, as I mentioned before, flexibility to meet local regional needs. I call it simultaneous loose type properties. That was one author did that. The last point there is that it's interesting. I think the thing I found is ironic is that so many of the things that I've mentioned are already taking place one form or another, and almost everything that I've touched upon has changed, doctrines and practices over the years, and all for the good. Of course, you've got a bunch of bright people running this organization as well as they're inspired. Allow a little more local innovation. One of the reasons is all the auxiliaries started as local efforts, and you all know about the welfare thing start up in Brigham City or somewhere in Harold B. Lee, and I think the young women's organization started in Brigham Young's house, and it's all the experimentation, what do we call it in evolution? It's mutation, and then they adapted. Anyway, I think we ought to allow some experimentation. Oh, okay, here's a couple of things I want to do real quickly. Consider giving, I think there should be thought given to granting bishops and other church leaders with very demanding callings tithing credit for their service. I do this because of my observation of the undue burden that has been placed upon bishops I have known and upon their families. Many less affluent bishops, stake presidents, etc., make real and significant financial sacrifice. I put etc., there are other people as well, in order to live up to their church callings. Fairness would dictate that they be recognized in some more formal way for this service. I mean, people used to donate labor on the temple and get tithing credit and all sorts of things. Okay, emeritus status should be expanded for general church officials, including apostles. Declining health and vitality can mean an undue burden on individuals in positions of demanding service. Diminishing capacity among top officials in any organization usually means the organization also loses effectiveness. Many churches have conventions similar to emeritus status and is likely to be perceived as unusual if the church were to expand it to other individuals. Another one, as I talk about taking a little bit of the emphasis away from stake and regional things, there should still be activities because that supports the idea of community, but I think a lot of people spend a lot of time doing things that they could direct their service where needed at the ward level and also outside of the church. Think about Yeah, talk about, I use the word the more effective use of resources. Yes, I think they ought to look at spending more money at the ward level, but certainly time. They're big demands. And in some places in Wasatch Front, my gosh, you're looking for ways to make people assistant role takers and all the rest because you've got people who've been in really society presidencies and bishoprics that have nothing to do. But in many wards, there's a dearth of time and resources. And anyway, I'm going to skip over that. Oh, the last one is another one. And I would consider creating an auxiliary focused on training teachers and other leaders and remove these functions from the other auxiliaries. You have amateurs trying to teach amateurs how to do things. Okay. Church callings and the accompanying opportunities for service are integral parts of the church experience. However, calling and willingness to serve are often not enough to equip individuals to serve effectively. This applies equally to those who train those who receive callings and those who train those who supervise those who receive callings. Long-term intensive preparation should be considered for those who serve in this auxiliary. Okay, I am at the end, Michael. The value of this presentation, if there is any, is to reinforce the idea that the LDS Church is an organization of human beings that exhibits most of the same issues, dysfunctions, and processes of most other organizations. It is not inconsistent with religious belief to employ principles of management and marketing to a church organization any more than it would be inconsistent for believing Christians to avail themselves of the advances in medical science. Successful organizations grow and adapt and learn. Indeed, the most successful organizations are ones that draw ideas from many sources and embrace positive change and do so more rapidly than their competitors. One of the great ironies I have encountered is the title of the magnum opus of the Tanners, which is meant to discredit the church. The book, by Moody Bible Press, I think, was titled The Changing World of Mormonism. It's seemingly accusatory, the title. I think it identifies the key to the church's success. Thank you.
All right, I'll make this quick because I have to. I like the disclaimer that John started with. What advice I would give the church if I were hired as a management consultant was the original title. I think those of us here would probably also have to sign on to a disclaimer along the lines of a title something like "Things I Would Like to Change About the Church If I Were in Charge." And given the reaction and involvement of most of us here, that's probably the case. I think it's very interesting that John ended with the a quick allusion to how Christians don't have a problem availing themselves of the advances of medical science for their application, treatment, things of that nature. I've often thought of the work that I've done as a consultant using the analogy of medicine as an application, because in many ways you're working as a physician with a patient. The more interesting medical analogy or illusion for me, though, is expressed by the question, how does one treat an alcoholic who's drunk on the elixir of power, who not only refuses treatment, but is convinced he doesn't have an illness? And the well, I'll give you an example. A lot of it has to do with your underlying assumptions and mental models. I'll start with the reverse. The worst thing to do is to have them hang around exclusively with other alcoholics who don't think that they have a drinking problem. That's the worst thing you could do. The best thing to do, there are a couple of options. One is to forge ahead and give them treatment, but then it puts you in the position of being an autocrat who uses coercion to compel others to stop using coercion and compelling others. Lots of problems with that as a strategy and a device. You can break off and ignore the whole thing. Of course, that's got a whole set of passive-aggressive issues to deal with as well. Never really resolves the issue. One of the best things you can do is to work to spin up that patient's interest and receptivity. Great suggestion. How do you do it? Well, best thing you can do is, believe it or not, start with cleansing the inner vessel before you work to remove the mote or the beam from someone else's eye. You need to make sure it's not in your own so that you're not inclined to want to use coercion and other things. In response to John's paper, I was thinking, okay, aside from being just a fun exercise, what if we really did have this chance to raise these kind of issues, to make these kind of questions and so on? How would we go about it? Well, one of the biggest barriers that that we would face up front is the idea of problems with mental models, underlying mental models, and underlying unspoken assumptions about what an ideal organization and its leadership should look like. For example, John talked about the correlated curriculum that we have in the church versus adapted pedagogy. And if you go through and you talk about correlated programs in the church, you know, the fact that we all are supposed to take the First Presidency message and we go home teaching and they give it back, and that you can go into any church, any sacrament meeting, anywhere in the church, anywhere in the world, and it's going to be exactly the same. And, you know, most of us in here are probably going to shake our heads and say, how tragic. Well, we had this conversation in my gospel doctrine a couple of months back, and everyone was sitting there going, how wonderful. you know, one man's a pleasure is another man's pain, so to speak. All of the underlying assumptions that we have are not commonly held about what would constitute ideal organization, ideal leadership, and so on. Since I'm out of time, I can suggest two things. Number one is we need to do as much listening and open dialogue as we can encourage from the other side and work towards a reciprocated agreement. The other thing is there are skill sets that we can develop to engage this activity or exercise. One thing, for example, is we can stop hoping that the larger and broader church will change and wishing that we had the ability or the capacity or the opportunity to go in and consult with the church. I think it's a much more pragmatic and useful thing to back up and say, okay, in that part of the vineyard where I do have influence, where I do have a voice, where I do have some say, I will make the changes that I can within my purview and my responsibility, so that if I end up as nothing more than the assistant nursery leader for the rest of my church career, I will make damn sure that the nursery in my ward is as open, egalitarian, free from coercion and manipulation as I possibly can. Thank you.